The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Welcome to Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We get to talk sports every weekend with a cast of interesting people right here on AM 950 and FM 94.9 The Answer in Orlando. Jeffrey Sennis does our engineering today. Andrew Hurd Liska produces this show for us each weekend. And in this first segment, Carter Williams joins us. He's in Salt Lake City, award-winning reporter. And we got a lot to talk about, Carter. It's nice to catch up with you.
I appreciate you having me on.
Carter, the first thing I want to dive into was this story a little bit ago about Utah, Salt Lake City, trying to become a Major League Baseball city. What is going on?
Yeah, so on April 12th, there was a coalition that came together and announced that they are seeking an expansion team. We now know that there's potentially the option that you have a relocation team. But at this point, you know, most of it is the expansion efforts. And this effort would be to, bring a team to Salt Lake City. It would be potentially either the 31st or 32nd team in the league. And, this is the push that they're trying to make, is saying, hey, we want a team here.
Why would the Salt Lake City area be ready for Major League Baseball? It's not that big a market.
Yeah, in terms of population, it definitely is one of those things that on paper doesn't look like it would be a great place to have any professional team, much less an MLB team, because Salt Lake City's population is only 200,000. That's less than many, many cities across the country. But the population demographics are kind of weird and wonky across the central area where all of the population is in Utah. So we're talking about a market that is 2.6 million people who live in the surrounding area around Salt Lake City. So it is a pretty substantial market that kind of compares with Charlotte when it comes to that matter. But there are other aspects of this that the leaders of this coalition are pushing forward. They're saying, hey, we have the growing economy. We have a growing population. We have all of these aspects, including a shovel-ready site as a part of some of the redevelopment that's happening in Salt Lake City at the moment. So with all of those things together, they're making this pitch and saying, hey, we are ready for a team.
Who is Gail Miller, and where does she fit in this story?
Yeah, so NBA fans will probably know who the Miller, or at least the diehard NBA fans, would know who Gail Miller is. She's the wife of the late Larry H. Miller, who had acquired the Utah Jazz in 1985 and then just continued to grow that team to the fact that it's a market that's not going away from the NBA. I think a lot of people would have assumed in 1979 when the New Orleans Jazz had moved to Utah that it would only be a temporary site, but it's thrived really well in Salt Lake City and did a successful run as the owner until the team was sold a few years ago. So she has a track record of running a successful organization in professional sports, and I think that really helps Salt Lake City's chances.
What kind of a ballpark are they thinking about?
Yeah, so that's the one thing that I think is a lot of intrigue right now among residents here in Salt Lake City and across the Wasatch Front, which is the region that Salt Lake City is in. And a lot of it is because it is currently a site that is sort of run down, and it's aging power utility site that would be circled out. But the utility provider, Rocky Mountain Power, owns all of this land, and they want to redevelop it because it's not being used anymore. And they're switching over to new technologies when it comes to electricity. So they have a ton of space on this west side of Salt Lake City that is kind of sandwiched between the downtown core and the Salt Lake City International Airport, which is also growing at a substantial rate right now. So it's kind of this interesting site. I think fans would eventually fall in love with it if it's anything similar to what the current minor league stadium is like, where you have these incredible views of the mountains in the distance. You would have Salt Lake City's downtown in that view. So I think it's really more or less looking at, you know, something that logistically makes sense in terms of travel, but also something that would be unique and special with the views.
My guest is Carter Williams. He's a award-winning reporter in Salt Lake City, and we're discussing this incredible story that broke a little while back about Utah, who's been under the radar on this whole baseball thing, suddenly emerged and said, we want a major league team. And Carter, with the move of the A's from Oakland to Vegas, that's one Western city that appears to be taken. And so now it could well come down out west to a battle between Salt Lake City and Portland for a team. Any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is sort of what we're looking at now. But, I mean, I've kind of looked at other cities as well that, you know, they could be sleeping giants in this route. We don't know when this expansion is going to be. We don't know when this announcement is going to be made. So obviously other cities could jump into the forefront, but it's a really interesting, if this is the head-to-head matchup, it's fascinating to see some of the, you know, the sides that have, are the arguments that are happening right now. You know, Portland is a team that is a market that's much larger. They've definitely been in this fight for a team much longer than Salt Lake City. But it's kind of interesting to see some of the folks that were behind this push in Portland, they're sort of jumping ship now, most notably, you know, former player that's from Portland, Dale Murphy, who now lives in Utah. And he decided to switch his allegiance from his hometown to his current town. So that's one of the more intriguing developments when it comes to this fight between the two sides. But it'll be interesting to see how that really plays out going forward, if it is those two cities, because some of the data and some of the demographics, some of the economic trends are going in different directions. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out when this decision is made, if it is made, of course.
Did Dale Murphy explain his thinking?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is he really enjoys Utah. And I think he's really made a push. He's found a real liking here in Utah. And I think a lot of that is behind his decision to jump allegiances and join Big League Utah in their fight for this MLB team.
What does Big League Utah mean?
So Big League Utah is this giant coalition that is behind this effort to bring an MLB team to Utah. And it is quite fascinating to see some of the names that are on here. We're talking about, you know, Utah senators that are on here. Other Utah leaders across the aisle have joined this coalition, as well as some of the more notable residents in Utah. They include some actors, some just local leaders and, of that nature. So it's kind of interesting to see this giant group of people who may not have the same political views, or they may not have the same societal views, but they are coming together and they say this is the place for a major league team.
My guest is Carter Williams out there in Utah. Tell me about the weather in Salt Lake for baseball. Early on in April, it would be very cold, right, unless there's a dome?
Yeah, that is definitely one question I have been asked probably the most when it comes to a stadium, whether it's a dome or a retractable roof. The thing is that Utah kind of dries out pretty quickly. We're talking about now with Major League changing its schedule that the season really starts in the end of March, which can be wet, it can be cold, but it kind of warms up and dries out very quickly. This year has been kind of anomalous when it comes to the weather. It has been much colder and much wetter than usual, especially in the last 20 to 30 years. But even so, there haven't been that many rainouts for the minor league team that is here in Salt Lake City, and they don't have a roof. So I think that it's a city that could host without having an issue. I think it's definitely a climate that is probably more well-adjusted for baseball weather without a roof than Minneapolis, and Minneapolis has no roof on their stadium, and they seem to do quite well themselves with that. So I think they could move forward without a retractable roof or a dome. And I think especially once it gets to summertime, when it dries out, it's nice and warm, sometimes even unpleasantly hot, but it's dry heat. So you have a lot of, I think a lot of people would enjoy the weather in the summertime.
Well, folks, Carter Williams is our guest from Salt Lake. We have another segment with him, so stay with us. And just a reminder, we are working hard trying to bring Major League Baseball here to Orlando. And you can be a big help. Go up to the website, OrlandoDreamers.com. OrlandoDreamers.com. And just let us hear from you. I'd like to know your feelings and like to know your thoughts on this. How do you feel about Orlando being a Major League Baseball city? We think that time has come, that Orlando is ready. Well, folks, this is Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and this is AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer, in Orlando, Florida. We'll be right back. Carter Williams is with us from Salt Lake City. We're talking sports with him. Carter, how did the NBA All-Star Weekend go over, do you think?
I think it was a success. It was definitely packed. A lot of people enjoyed the events that were happening all around the city. I think there were a good mixture of events that families and residents could afford and could go to, and then there was the events, the major events, they went out without a hitch. I know that there were some complaints made from some of the former NBA players who now work in media, calling it, quote, a boring city, and you know, to each their own. I think Salt Lake City is a little bit different than some of the other markets out there in the NBA. But overall, it was a success. Everything seemed to move, you know, pretty well. And we'll look eventually to see what the economic numbers were from it. But there weren't really any major hiccups that I noticed, even attending some of these events. So I think it was pretty successful.
Carter, what does the Jazz mean to fans and people in Utah?
Oh, man, the Jazz, they are sort of the uniting force when it comes to sports here in Utah. So there's two huge schools that are heated rivals in this area, the University of Utah and Brigham Young University. And these two schools, they have a very passionate rivalry. But it's fascinating to see even the opposing coaches go to the game together when it comes to a Jazz game. And it's sort of this uniting force where even if you like Utah or like BYU, you like the Jazz. And it's sort of this community beacon, really, that has brought so many people together. It's kind of lovely to see it. It's something that as the only major four franchise currently in the state, it's something that everyone gravitates to, whether it's in northern Utah, southern Utah, in this region. It's just it's such a uniting force, and I think that's really why that franchise has continued to grow even 40 years later.
Carter, I'm going to give you some names, and you tell me what thoughts you have. Danny Ainge.
Well, it's been interesting to see how there's been a shift in some of the changes that have happened. Obviously, the Jazz are in a rebuild at the moment, and Danny Ainge, I think, is a craftsman when it comes to trades, which, you know, he had already built a reputation in Boston. And for him to come home after, you know, being at BYU and being sort of a legend there and taking over the role that he has now and with the Jazz and making some of the trades that they made over the last offseason, that proved to be super successful. They got a ton out of Rudy Gobert. They got a ton out of Donovan Mitchell. And I think, you know, the growth that I think nobody saw coming in Lauri Markkanen was spectacular. And it's kind of interesting to see where the direction goes from here, considering that they sort of figured some of the young core. Walker Kessler was terrific this year as a rookie. So they have sort of a core that they can build around, and they have a ton of draft picks to build around that. And so the first thing that comes to mind is just he's a genius when it comes to rebuilding.
Karl Malone.
Absolute legend. His statue is one of two that are outside of the arena that the Jazz play at. I think he will continue to just be the legend that he is, and that he brought so much joy to a lot of the people growing up in this state, especially in his playing time.
John Stockton.
I would say very equal. They are two equal players. In fact, they both have streets named after each other that intersect, and they intersect right where their statues are aligned together. So everything I have to say about Karl Malone is probably exactly the way that Utah fans feel about John Stockton.
Frank Layden.
Oh, that guy is, he's the best. He is a frequent visitor to Salt Lake Bees games, who is the minor league team that currently exists here in Salt Lake City, and will at times even sing the seventh inning stretch and all that stuff. He's such a kind individual who really was the force that kept the Jazz going in the initial years in Utah, and I think he's just a beloved figure in the city.
The University of Utah football program.
They are absolutely top-notch at this point, and they've kind of led the Pac-12 the last few years. They are sort of a force that has started to knock on the the possibility of being a playoff team the last few years, and it'll be interesting to see with the college football expansion where they go. I think in this most recent season, if the expansion was applied to this most recent season, they would have been a playoff team, and they're just they're a force right now. Kyle Whittingham seems to have a tight ship every year that is pretty good, and you know, fighting for the Pac-12 titles and whatnot. And you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they are strong again this year.
The sport of skiing in your neck of the woods.
Oh, that's the lifeblood of sports in Utah. You see right now with Salt Lake City vying for another Winter Olympics. But this year in particular has been extremely incredible in terms of snow amounts. And it's allowed for a lot of the ski resorts here. There are 15 all across the state of Utah, not just in this region, but all across the state. And a lot of them broke records this year in terms of the amount of times that they were open for the first time. And it's one of the passions that continues to drive a lot of the recreation out here in Utah.
Rivalry with Denver in basketball, and could it be baseball?
Yeah, that will be interesting. It's kind of fascinating that the owner of the Colorado Rockies recently talked about wanting a team in Salt Lake City. He's a University of Utah alum, so there's a little bit of that tie-in there. He's kind of backing Salt Lake City's efforts. It would be fun. I think there definitely is some sort of a rivalry there. I mean, not as much this past season now that the Jazz are in that rebuild, but there is sort of that the Mountain City rivalry where it's like which one is really the city of the mountains sort of thing. And I think it would be fun to continue that when it comes to potentially adding a major league team or even potentially a hockey team that could come to Utah.
Are they trying to get the NHL there?
There has been some efforts. The Utah Jazz owner recently tweeted that that there's more to come, essentially, when it comes to that. He has met with Gary Bettman and NHL. So it's a different group that's behind that push. But it is something that is also kind of potentially in the works in the future of Utah.
Tell me about the Jazz's new owner.
Yeah, Brian Smith, I think, is really at the forefront of sort of the Silicon Slopes and a lot of the growth that has happened with the tech industry in Utah and across the Wasatch Front region. He's just a charismatic, younger tech individual who grew up as a huge Jazz fan, and so for Gail Miller, I think she felt like he was the perfect candidate she was going to sell the team and make sure that team is always in Utah. That Ryan Smith is the perfect candidate for that.
Where does Dwayne Wade fit into all this?
Yeah, Dwayne Wade, I think he's credited Ryan Smith as sort of a mentor as he kind of turns in from, you know, the NBA legend that he was in Florida. And I'm sure your listeners know all too well about his successes in Miami and just such a terrific basketball player. But as he's grown older, I think he's really moving on to being sort of a business mogul, and he's credited Ryan Smith toward some of that goal, and then he was able to come into this organization. I think he's done a really good job in terms of helping out with the growth and the changes that are happening with the Utah Jazz.
Carter, we got 30 seconds to do Jerry Sloan.
Jerry Sloan, I think, is one of those guys who will always be revered in the state. He's one of those individuals that always will be remembered for leading those teams that came so close to winning a pair of titles, really. They were one Michael Jordan short of winning a championship, and I think there's a lot of love and admiration for Jerry Sloan in the state.
Carter Williams has been our guest, award-winning reporter who covers general news, outdoors, history, and sports for KSL.com in Salt Lake City. We got more after this. The show, Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and this is AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Carter Williams, our guest in that first segment out in Salt Lake City. We got a chance to talk sports with him, particularly this Utah effort now to become a Major League Baseball city. Well, we go from Salt Lake City to Philadelphia, my roots. Michael Bamberger is there, senior writer for the Fire Pit Collective, legendary golf writer. His new book is out, The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure. Michael, welcome to Orlando. It's so nice to visit with you.
Thank you so much. I've logged a lot of nights in your city, as all sports writers have.
That's great. So tell me about this book, Michael, that's just come out.
Well, this book, I've written a lot about professional golf over a lot of years now. I first got exposed to the PGA Tour in 1979, and I kind of wanted to run away with their circus ever since. But I have a longtime editor named Jofi Ferrari Adler at Simon & Schuster. He's a good golfer himself, and he edited, by the way, the book that I'm sure some of your listeners will know about Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. But anyway, with the advent of LIV coming on the scene, the Saudi-backed golf league, and all the noise surrounding professional golf, he thought this might be a great moment in the game, in the history of the game, to document what amateur golf means. And so he came up with the idea, and I really was delighted to run with it, because that's 99.9% of us is regular Joe golfers. And so I found three that I think embody different places in their golfing lives, and it adds up to the thing we all know about called, that the game is one for a lifetime.
It's an exhilarating love letter to the amateur game as it's played and lived by the rest of us. Can you expand on that?
Well, yes, because... Pat, how old were you when you first played golf or had a golf club in hand?
Oh, I was very young, but it didn't stick. when I came down to Orlando in 1986, everything revolves down here around golf. Oh my!
Right.
It's golf in every direction you turn.
Right, and. So as you were into middle age by that point, but it doesn't really matter when you get smitten by the game. If you get smitten by the game, you'll probably find over time that different aspects of the game offer a different rabbit hole to go down. So you might start with this basic idea of, can I get the ball in the air? And then, can I get on a golf course? Can I break 100? Can I beat my buddy? But over time, you develop interests in lots of other things, like the purpose of the rule book and the ethical consideration of the rule book. Golf as a meritocracy, that it doesn't really matter who you are or how you grew up if you can play the game. The sociology of golf clubs, the architecture of golf courses, the engineering of golf clubs. There are so many different aspects of the game. And if you're lucky enough to have been in the game for a long time, like you and I both have now, over time, different aspects of the game will start to fascinate you. So I hope that people will come away from this book seeing themselves, and maybe, and if you're not a golfer, but you know a golfer, and that's a lot of people, feeling more connected to this really unusual, magical, mystery game, sport, quasi-religion. It's a lot of different things to different people.
Why does the game of golf cast such a spell on us?
I think because it's ultimately unknowable and in something you can't perfect. There's a famous nightmare of Ben Hogan's. It will sound like a dream, but it turns out to be a nightmare in Hogan's version of it, or as it's come down to me. He makes 17 straight holes in one, and then on the 18th, he whips out. So perfection is unattainable. Now, this is something Tiger started. It never even occurred to Nicklaus and others. For Tiger was, if I win by six, it should have been seven. It's something, there's always something sort of unsatisfying about it, and there's always something sort of very satisfying about it. And I think in that, I know this will sound pretentious to non-golfers, but I really believe it. I think golfers will understand it. In its quest for perfection, and then the knowledge that, you know, it's not perfectible, but you want to keep trying, it very much reflects life.
Tell me about the Balmoral Castle in Scotland.
Huh. Have you ever been to the Balmoral Castle in Scotland?
No, I have not.
Well, I know nothing about the royal family. My wife is a Anglophile, and she knows a lot about the royal family. So last summer, I'm lucky enough to have gone to the British Open 24 times. You know, I go every year to cover it, many years for Sports Illustrated, and last year for the Fire Pit Collective. the Open was in St. Andrews, which was a thrill. And then afterwards, my wife came over, and we went touring, and we wound up in the little town of Inverness, way in the north of Scotland. And then we made a side trip to Balmoral Castle, and I knew nothing about it except for Christine, my wife, explained to me that it's the summer residence of the royal family. The Queen was still alive at the time. And like a lot of things my wife drags me to, you know, I went in with no interest or going only because I knew she was interested. And it turns out to be absolutely fascinating. But it's just a beautiful mansion where the royal family lives. But way beyond that, it has all the hundreds, if not thousands, of acres of parkland and walkways. It's open to the public. But then there's a charming little 9-hole course that's very playable, and it's for the royal family, but it's also for employees and their families. So it's a fringe benefit. And we had the same thing here in Philadelphia. Bethlehem Steel used to own golf courses in and around Bethlehem at the Saucon Valley Country Club. And if you worked at Bethlehem Steel, you had access to these courses. So if you work at Balmoral Castle for the royal family, you have access to this charming little 9-hole course. And there are dogs walking on. It's just very, very charming little place.
Tell me, Michael, about the National Hickory Championship in rural Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, for anybody who wants to play in a national championship, like, let's say, the U.S. Open, Pat, you or I could get our golf games in shape where we could attempt to qualify for the U.S. Open, or what Arnold Palmer, who, of course, lived in Orlando, who I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with, and I'm sure you did as well, called the National Open. And the requirement to play in the National Open is a certain handicap or to try to qualify for it, and it's roughly around 2. In other words, you got to be maybe roughly a 75 shooter or better. And then you can sign up for a local qualifying and then a sectional qualifying. If you do well in those two events, then you can play in the U.S. Open itself. You play the first two rounds. If you do well in those first two rounds, then you play the Saturday and Sunday rounds. Well, the reason I give you that whole long preamble is because the National Hickory Championship is open to anybody. You can just go on the website and sign up. I did it last year. It moves around and it's played at different courses. And last year it was played on a 19th century course in Foxburg, Pennsylvania. I was at the Memorial Tournament in Dublin, Ohio, Jack Nicklaus's tournament. And I went from there to Foxburg. And you play the National Hickory Open with literally with 19th century clubs. I came with clubs that were from the early 20th century, and I was quickly told that they were not acceptable. They have to be before the 19th century. The clubs are made of wood. The grips are made of leather. The ball it resembles our modern ball, but it doesn't fly anything like our modern balls. A long course for hickory clubs is 4,500 yards as opposed to 6,000 plus that most men golfers play. And if you just slug a drive, it might go 30, maybe 40 feet in the air, and I could hit it about 140 odd yards. But anyway, it's a tremendous amount of fun. You wear period garb. The people are all a little kooky and a lot of fun. And a lot of these people who play hickory golf and play in this national championship, they only play hickory golf. They have no interest in modern golf. And having done it for a couple of days, I can see the appeal.
And I want you to talk about Lee Trevino.
Pat, I love this interview. Now, did you ever know the name Brian Lamb, who founded?
Oh yes.
I think CNBC.
Yes.
Now, did you ever remember his interviews with writers?
I watched.
They were on late.
I watched him. I was a big fan.
I was too, and this was his interview style. He'd have on, let's say, Bob Woodward of the Washington Post or whomever, and he'd say, "High school." Well, that meant you were supposed to tell him about your high school experience. This guy wasted no words whatsoever, and your colleague producer told me, be prepared to do 97% of the talking. And now I understand. So the Brian Lamb version of this question is St. Andrews, and now my job is to tell you about St. Andrews. Have you ever been, Pat?
No, I have not, Michael, but I'll tell you what. We've got to take a break, and when we come back, that'll be the first topic. But I'll tell you this, Michael, I do not want to finish this interview without you talking about the beloved Arnold Palmer, who still is very much alive and well here in Orlando.
And a buddy of yours, I imagine.
We're both Wake Forest guys.
Oh, wow. I'd forgotten that. I did know that. I did forget that. That's neat.
A few years apart, but he was a deacon as I was, so... All right, Michael Bamberger, he's in Philadelphia. We're talking about his book, The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure. The show is Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and this is AM 950 and FM 94.9. The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Michael Bamberger, who is often called, Golf Magazine called him the poet laureate of golf. We're talking about his book, The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure. And so, Michael, we're going to pick it right up with St. Andrews and Lee Trevino.
Well, St. Andrews, Tiger Woods, whom I've covered since he was an amateur, others have covered him more closely than I, but I have covered him quite closely. He is capable of being charming. That's not his first thing. Arnold was really charming. We'll get to Arnold in a minute. But if you say the word St. Andrews in front of Tiger Woods, this phrase comes to mind, home of golf, home of golf, where it all began, home of golf. And it is absolutely true. So like any basketball fan who goes to Springfield, Massachusetts, any baseball fan who goes to Cooperstown, New York, to go to St. Andrews, which I would urge anybody who has the opportunity to do so, is like going to a living, breathing golfing museum. There are one, two, three, I think there are four courses right in the town of St. Andrews. The golf courses start right in town. But there's also cathedrals and a university and all sorts of restaurants and bookstores. And it's a vibrant city with a lot going on beyond the Gulf. But you really feel the connection of our ancestors who've been playing golf, or golfing ancestors who've been playing there for, I don't know the precise number, but hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's a woman that I've gotten to know. Her name is Sheila Walker. Now, I may not have the greats here correctly, but I believe she is the great-great-granddaughter of a man named Old Tom Morris. And Old Tom Morris was essentially the superintendent of the old course as the 19th century was turning into the 20th century. And she lives in his house. So to be with Sheila Walker and know of her DNA connection to Old Tom Morris and Old Tom Morris's connection to this ancient piece of golf and play field is just thrilling for me. And anybody who goes to St. Andrews will have their own kind of experience like that. So you'll hear a lot. I've been lucky enough to go to Augusta National many times to cover the Masters. I've been lucky enough to play it a number of times. It's great. It's fantastic. Of course, anybody would want to do that. But if you could only do one, I would put the old. I would say, save up, do what you can to try to get to the old course at least once in your lifetime, and to St. Andrews.
Michael, your thoughts on Arnold Palmer?
Arnold Palmer was someone that I was lucky enough to know. I would like to say quite well. I had a lot of intimate interviews with Arnold Palmer. I think he was very comfortable talking about himself in a very not in a bragging kind of way, just sort of truthfully. He did a lot. He had a lot of successes. He had a lot of failures. He was open about both. He wasn't someone who, for a reporter, ever sort of postured. This is famously true about Arnold, but I'm mentioning it because I experienced it, and Pat, I know you experienced it as well. When Arnold Palmer shook your hand and looked you in the eye, you felt that time had stopped and that there was nothing else going on in the world. He really had an unusual capacity to connect with other human beings. And had he gone into politics or business or anything else, he would have had those exact same qualities. And there's so much I could say about Arnold Palmer, but I would want to say this one thing, because it really, I think, captures. I'll say two great things about him. Dave Anderson, who is a friend of mine, who was a contemporary of Arnold's to the year, was a long time. Pat, did you know Dave Anderson from the New York Times?
I did.
He was a gent of all gents. And Dave used to say, no matter who you are, you can't enjoy being you more than Arnold Palmer enjoyed being Arnold Palmer. And I thought that was a great, great insight into Arnold. And the other thing I would say about Arnold is, and this is a telling comment about Arnold in the context of LIV Golf and everything that's happening with that right now. Arnold was big. Arnold, of course, like all superstars, had an ego. Arnold made a lot of money from golf. But, and it's a really significant butt clause here, he never thought the game was bigger than he. And he always carried himself with that as a basic fundamental understanding, even as big as he began. And that served golf tremendously well, and it served Arnold well as well. And I think Arnold helped Jack Nicklaus understand that. I think Jack would have figured that out on his own, of course, and did. And Tom Watson, and I would like to say Tiger Woods. And I hope Woods will pass that down to the next generation.
Jack Nicklaus is saying these days, Michael, that the game is too slow, that the hitters are too good. A little critical of the game. Your thoughts?
It is, of course, ironic to the point of almost laugh out loud to hear Jack Nicklaus say that the game was too slow, because few golfers in his era were more methodical and deliberate than Jack Nicklaus. He stalked, and he hit that ball when he was ready to hit that ball. And it was part and parcel of his personality. He's a very cerebral person. Pat, I imagine you've met him probably a number of times, maybe know him quite well. But he was ready to play. In other words, he got on top of his ball quickly, but then took a lot of time over the ball. From Jack Nicklaus to today, there's been a sea change by which players at every level, the PGA Tour right down to yours and your level and mine, because we watch on TV and it's monkey see, monkey do. We don't pull the club until the other guy has played. We don't start calculating the wind and the yardage as if, for most of us, it's going to make any difference whatsoever. And the game has become tragically, pathetically, harmfully slow. So to hear Jack Nicklaus say the game is too slow, and he was with Lee Trevino and Annika Sorensen, and I think Gary Player most recently when he made this comment again, is really, really a telling thing. But part and parcel with that comment is this comment, and Jack's been saying this. I have the highest admiration for Jack as golfing royalty and as a great original golf thinker. I would put Lee Trevino in the same category. The ball goes too far. Now, this is the part people aren't paying enough attention to for them. When they talk about rolling back the golf ball, Pat, have you followed this at all, this movement by the USGA and the RNA?
Yes.
To have the ball? You have followed it. You know, many have, and some just missed it. People think that they're coming after our yardage, and our distance, I should say. They're not. What they want is for elite golfers, like at the PGA Tour level, to play a ball that goes marginally shorter than it does now. And reading between the lines of this, I don't even think they'll achieve that. I think they'll, if they're lucky, they'll just hold it in place. But part of the reason why Nicklaus is saying this is, if the ball goes so far that you need a longer course takes longer to walk, it's more expensive to maintain, it requires more water, more seed, more fertilizer, more expense, it makes the game that much more difficult, that much more time-consuming, that much more expensive. Nothing good comes out of having a golf ball that can be routinely hit 300 yards by the best players in the world. Now, people confuse this. Oh, now we're going to have this phrase bifurcation. One rules for them, one rules for us. The game already is bifurcated. We don't play the way they play at all. Most of us, if we're playing casual round, we hit out of bounds, we just drop or went out of bounds. We play different golf balls on different holes. Nobody cares. We create rules as we go along. Oh, you can't make worse than the seven. Whatever it might be, within our group, within our match, we make up our own rules. They do something that is actually quite different, much more exacting, much more demanding, like the situation at the Masters where Brooks Koepka's caddy mouthed the word five to Gary Woodland's caddy. And people say, who cares? It matters because the exchange of information, which is against the rule book, changes everything about the mindset of the player. At our level, no one cares. And whether we're going to hit the five iron well enough is, you know, happenstance anyhow. So my starting point is that we do play different games, and the elite golfer should have a different ball. And that's what Nicklaus is saying when he says the game is too slow, or it's part of what he's saying.
Michael, I'm fascinated by Tiger Woods' son. What do you think?
Well, he's a delightful kid. I've never talked to him. Maybe asked him a question or two at a when he's with his dad playing in the father, what they used to call the father son tournament in Orlando that I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about. He's got a beautiful, natural, flowing swing. It is very reminiscent of Tiger when he was a teenager. He has a very confident manner. The first time I really picked up on that was after Tiger won the Masters in 2019, his 15th professional major championship. He was invited to the White House to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And Tiger's son and daughter were there. And you know, it's a big formal event, and it's, you know, one of the greatest honors a civilian, maybe the single greatest honor a civilian could get in our country. And this kid was just like the life of the party and having a great time. So he's a promising young golfer. He seems like he's loaded with personality. He seems comfortable in his own skin. And just one quick thing about him. At one of the father-son tournaments, I think they played together now twice, maybe three times. I'm sorry, I'm just not remembering right now. I think I was there for two of them and missed one. So I think three. And the kid was walking down the fairway when he dropped his driver. This is no big deal. You know, people, you drop your driver all the time. It just slips out of your hand. And Tiger was walking with his playing partner, I think Justin Thomas. And Tiger just walked over the driver that the kid dropped. And it was like, and so many fathers or so many parents in that situation would be like, oh, you dropped the club. Let me pick it up for you. And Tiger was like, yeah, you dropped it. You picked it up. You picked it up. You know, just, which is, I think that's parenting 101. And I just think that's for sure how Earl raised Tiger. It was just a quiet little moment. But, you know, it was neat to see that. It was neat to see father just treat the kid like a kid.
Michael
They seem to have a great, great bond.
Michael Bamberger has been our guest. The book, The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure. Thanks for joining us here on Inside the Game. We are back next weekend and look forward to having you join us. I'm your host, Pat Williams. Always love having you. It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Have a wonderful week ahead. Good sports to all of you.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.